Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba, Asheda, Mojuba, Aluwa, Mi, Apolabi, Pega, Mojuba, Araba, Mi, Adesanya, Awuyade, Mojuba, Ogute, Compound, Ode, Remo, Mojuba, Baba, Mojuba, Yeye, Mojuba, Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba, Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba, Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. We began the UAC after the unjust Thurman verdict of July 2013, and we ask that you please continue to support us and our sponsors. Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host, Dr. James Jones. You can find Dr. Jones on Facebook as James Jones, as well as on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com and as a liking group page on Facebook as well. And support Arlie Gordon out of Detroit, for Unity Design. Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. You can find Brother Arlie on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And again, Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. And last but not least, we want to always remember to never forget our beloved brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines and the families and loved ones and friends that they represent. So please reach out to Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement, respectively, on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. We also want to ask you to pay a particular attention to the Redistribute the Pain campaign that is initiated by not only the Free Alabama Movement, but the National Freedom Movement as well, to address the issue of mass incarceration and the fact that not only do the private prisons continue to make money by over-prosecuting and punishing and abusing and misusing our brothers and sisters, but they also charge exorbitant amounts for things like ramen noodles. They're charged for their ID bracelets. They're charged every time they take an aspirin. You know, anything, any and everything they possibly can charge our brothers and sisters for, they do. And that's just not even mentioning the food and commissary and phone calls. And now they have video calling and all that kind of stuff you can do to see, you know, your loved ones. But if our loved ones were free, we would not have to be going through what we're going through in order to keep in touch with one another. And, you know, for those that have loved ones behind enemy lines and maybe you haven't spoken to them in a while, you're wondering how they're doing. I'm sure they're wondering how you're doing as well. Please reach out to them, you know, because things like that make a big difference when our brothers and sisters are dealing with such a oppressive system on a day-to-day basis. You know what we deal with out here in the quote-unquote free world, but our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines deal with way worse. So please reach out to your loved ones who are behind enemy lines, even if you haven't talked to them in a while, even if it's, you know, awkward for you to, because I'm sure it would do them a world of good to hear from you. So tonight we're going to have a listen and learn session. And the reason why we're rolling this is obvious. There are tactics that are able to be used even when you're not in warfare that still are very strategic. When you are planning or implementing something that could be and should be considered revolutionary. So enjoy tonight's listen and learn session. Please get a pencil and paper out. The first one deals with the beginning of guerrilla warfare, and then the second piece deals with guerrilla warfare in an urban environment. And so I'm going to do the best I can to get these played back-to-back. But should we need to, we may have to play a brief piece or a brief lecture piece in between because the second piece is actually still downloading. I'm going to just keep it real with y'all. So enjoy tonight's listen and learn session. Again, the beginning piece is the beginning of guerrilla warfare, and then the second piece deals with guerrilla warfare in an urban environment. Last but not least, I want to, again, welcome our newest member to the Sign of the Times family. And sponsorship family, Amira Sankofa-Kweli. She has a commercial running here on Sign of the Times, and we appreciate her support. You can reach out to her at area code 502-208-9142, and she has all kinds of remedies and herbs and crystals, and she does Reiki. She is a very spiritually sound and sound sisters. So please reach out to Amira Sankofa-Kweli out of Louisville, Kentucky. Her phone number is area code 502-208-9142. Enjoy tonight's listen and learn session, everyone. And if you have a question or a comment, feel free to push one as we proceed, and I will bring you into queue. All right, this is Queen Tahira. Hit me up if you need me, 513-913-2691, 513-913-2691. Also, as Queen Tahira on Facebook, Queen underscore Tahira on Instagram, and at Queen Tahira on Twitter. And of course, New Power Radio Network and Sign of the Times and the Free Alabama Movement and Free Ohio Movement. Just search me, you'll find me. I promise. All right, enjoy tonight's listen and learn. I'll talk to you on the other side. Salute.
Death is a multi-billion dollar industry. The cemeteries are full of people who've passed from a preventative illness. With the correct approach, you not only extend your chances of preserving your life, but you will improve the quality of your life with a natural approach. The earth provides energy healing herbs for the benefit of mankind.
Hello, I'm Amira Sankofa Kwali here at Ask Life Coaching Ministry. We're located at 1921 West Broadway. We've been in the healing business for over 20 years. To order my products, go to www.ask314life.com. I'm available 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. No machine.
The events in question form part of the Great Arab Revolt from 1916 to 1918. On one side is the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which is now allied with Germany. On the other side are the local people, the Arab tribes, who have suffered imperial rule for nearly 400 years. Supporting them are the British. British strategy, like that of the Western Front, would call for a head-on attack.
The problem was they are composed mainly of tribal irregulars who are lightly equipped, so their firepower is only a fraction of the firepower of the Ottoman army. So if the Arabs were going to fight and win this war, they were going to have to do it in a very different way from a conventional army fighting the kind of trench warfare that was going on elsewhere.
Facing this crisis, many believe Lawrence starts to devise a new strategy.
He brought an outsider's mind to the issues and the problems. He didn't really follow the normal path to being an officer in the British Army. He was drafted into the intelligence service because of his knowledge of Arabic and Arab traditions. Before Lawrence joined the British Army, he was an archaeologist. He lived with the Arabs. He spoke their language. He understood.
Unencumbered by military training, with a sharp insight into the Arab culture, Lawrence is able to see alternatives to conventional warfare. In his book, Lawrence describes turning the Arabs' military weakness into a strength. The idea is to use independent, almost invisible guerrilla bands traveling light and swiftly.
He's using the Arab mobility. He's really using the Arabs in the way that for centuries they had used themselves. These are raiding parties, and then only instead of fighting each other, they're fighting the Turks or attacking Turkish objectives.
Experts in desert survival, their attacks against their imperial rulers, the Ottoman Turks, could happen anywhere, even in remote desert.
He suddenly realizes that let's not have frontal battles with the Turks. Let's just attack their lines of communication.
The theory is to use the Arab mobility in the desert to mount attacks on the railway all across Arabia, forcing the Turks to defend their essential supply lines, paralyzing them.
He understood, increasingly through time, the ideas in the Arab mind of raiding. And he adapted that to modern industrial warfare. He came up with something completely new. Modern guerrilla warfare has become the way of war in the 20th and 21st century. And this is where it began.
When you have a government that operates without limits, which proclaims the right to arrest, torture, and kill anyone, anywhere, with no warrants, no trial, no due process, when you have a government that militarizes the police and grants the armed forces the power to operate with impunity within your own borders and beyond, a government that views you, the people, as the enemy and treats you as such, when you have a government that lies to take you into wars of aggression, toppling country after country, killing countless innocent civilians, sending your sons and daughters, your fathers and brothers home in flag-draped coffins, were disfigured and broken in mind and body, their lives destroyed in wars that serve only to line the pockets of an unelected cartel of bankers and corporations. When you have all of this right in front of you, so blatant, so clear, with president after president towing the line of the same agenda, shouldn't have to be convinced that both parties in this political puppet show are owned and operated by the same interests. And you shouldn't have to be convinced that these overrated corporate popularity contests, as some call elections, are distractions that achieve nothing. And if you see where this is headed, you shouldn't have to be convinced that the system that you're living under must be brought to a halt. These are obvious conclusions for those who've been paying attention, so we won't try to convince you here. This video focuses solely on how to bring that system to a halt. Think of it as an instruction manual for a revolution. There are those who will be taken aback when you start using the word revolution. Revolution, the act of revolting and overturning the current power structure, is an extreme measure, one that should be handled with extreme caution, and in most cases, they should be avoided. Revolutions are dangerous in every sense of the word, and it is difficult, if not impossible, to predict their outcome. But there are times when allowing those in control to stay in control is even more dangerous. Right now, the question you need to ask yourself is this: are we at that point yet? Can the current system be reformed? Revolutions begin with a no, and they end with a yes. Revolutions begin when you say no to those who claim to have power over you. And revolutions end when you accept a new status quo, a new normal, whether that new normal is an improvement or not. The causes of revolution are numerous in form, but there is one common root, and that's discontent. Discontent is the emotion that builds and builds under the surface. It is a storm which brews in the mind of the people, just waiting to be unleashed. The trouble is that it's much easier to unleash that storm than it is to get people in agreement as to what should come next. It's not easy to get people to see eye to eye regarding what needs to happen after the current system falls. So this is usually put off, or avoided altogether. And that's a serious mistake. Without clear objectives, chaos usually sets in soon after the old regime falls. And then, in the power vacuum that's created, a tyrant rises to bring order. As a result, the systems that follow revolutions are often just as totalitarian or more totalitarian than those that they replace. It should therefore be abundantly obvious that discontent is not a sufficient driving force for a revolution. That is, if your goal is to actually leave a better world for your children and grandchildren. In order for an upheaval to have positive results, it must be driven by a clear and realistic vision. A vision that accounts for the world and humans the way that they actually are right now. Not the way that we wish they would be, or that we hope that they might be. And it must differentiate between that which can and cannot be changed in the short term. There is nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. So, let's be realistic, shall we? We the people are divided. We have divided ourselves into classes and subclasses, liberals and conservatives, libertarians, anarchists, socialists, anarcho-socialists, minarchists, state-based free market capitalists, anarcho-capitalists, resource-based economy advocates, and more. There is absolutely no chance that any one of you is going to convince all the others that your way is the right way. Unless, of course, one of you rises to political power in the fray and enforces your beliefs by the barrel of a gun. This is the way it usually happens throughout history, and this is what we must avoid repeating. The movement is only successful if it starts with an idea that is strong enough to take root in the mind of the population and inspires and motivates people to spread it. It is possible for a diverse and divided people to form a coalition in times of great need and unify around an idea, but it only works if that idea meets the following three requirements. 1. It must articulate a clear and defined common interest which allow the people to work together. The necessity for unification, even if that unification is temporary, needs to be evident to all stakeholders, and it must be accompanied by a sense of urgency which impels people to reach out to others in their community and spread the idea. 2. A clear vision of what you're working towards. What are you going to replace the current system with? Ironing out the fine details isn't actually productive. What's needed is a broad and abstract vision based on principles. In human societies, extreme and abrupt changes are usually destructive. All efforts must be made to retain social stability. This means steering clear of any sort of utopian fantasies. The time to rewire humanity is not during a period of crisis. Historically, such attempts usually end in tragedy. 3. A plan of action and a clear understanding of the rules of engagement. We'll refer to these three elements collectively as the conscious revolution paradigm. You don't have to get mystical about it. It just means think before you act. Let's start with the common interest. Establishing the common interest is easy if you're informed. And if the people around you aren't informed, then your job is clear. Inform them. Whether you consider yourself a liberal or conservative or none of the above, the bankers and the corporations which hold the puppet strings of the state have placed us all on a path that leads to complete and total destruction. Our common interest is the world that we're leaving our children. The clear vision of what we're working towards is much harder. Again, there's nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. And there's no greater symptom of utopianism than the illusion that we can convince the entire world to accept one monolithic belief system. Yet, at the same time, all great movements are driven by an idea. They're driven by a vision. How do we resolve this apparent contradiction? How do we find a common vision without falling for the naive fantasy that we can unify all worldviews? The answer is actually pretty simple. And that's a good thing, because only very simple ideas can be transmitted from person to person without breaking down. Our vision must start with the foundational understanding that there's not one single right way for humans to live on this planet, and that it is unacceptable to force others into any system without their consent, or to use violence or coercion to compel them to obey a set of rules that they never agreed to. That should just be common sense, but it's really not for most people. Most people like to use government thugs to enforce their good intentions. They just don't like it when it comes home to roost and the gun is pointed in their face. When the current system falls, there's going to be no way to reconstitute it in its old shape and size without violence and coercion, and even that probably wouldn't work. Therefore, the only real ethical option is to accept that Humpty Dumpty isn't going to be put back together again. When it's time to rebuild, we don't need to figure out one system that everybody can fit under. Rather, we need to figure out an approach which facilitates multiple systems side by side. What would this look like? Well, imagine a network of small, voluntarily formed communities bound together in loose federations that cooperate for mutual defense and trade as needed, with decision-making taking place at the local level. It's a simple concept, one that's been applied many times throughout history. The most striking example, however, is the Iroquois Federation, which unified six tribes, each with their own cultures and traditions. The Iroquois Federation existed before the arrival of Columbus and lasted until 1779 when they were conquered militarily by the U.S. Many historians believe that the Iroquois Federation served as the original inspiration for the United States. The most striking difference being that the Iroquois Federation never had a central government. No one at the top had the power to force the member tribes to do anything whatsoever. And yet, this system worked, and it worked well for a very long time. So clearly this is not a utopian fantasy. It's a viable option, and it's the only option that can be enacted on a voluntary basis. The final element of the conscious revolution paradigm is the plan of action, the strategy and tactics, the short-term and long-term goals, and the structure of the movement. So let's start with the top-level strategy and move towards tactics. Some think of revolution in terms of bullets and bombs, but this is a misconception. Revolutions are about pulling the pillars of power out from underneath the state, one by one, until it falls. The state leans on three primary pillars of power. One, the control of the group mind, ideas, and beliefs. Two, the control of money, finance, and thereby human activity. And three, the monopoly on violence and the use of intimidation to extract obedience by fear. There are three stages of revolution, and they are sequential, and they correlate directly with the three pillars of power. The first is the ideological revolution. This is where we undermine the belief systems which support their control. This is where we systematically erode their illusion of legitimacy, their aura of power. We expose these criminals for the scoundrels that they are, and we inspire discontent among those who the state depends on for its functioning. If you're new to this, welcome to the party. It's already in full swing, and guess what? We're winning. The powers that be have lost control of the dialogue, and they know it.
In recent decades, worldwide social change has experienced unprecedented historical acceleration, particularly because instant mass communications, such as radio, television, and the internet, cumulatively have been stimulating a universal awakening of mass political consciousness. The resulting widespread rise in worldwide populist activism is proving inimical to external domination of the kind that prevailed in the age of colonialism and imperialism. Persistent and highly motivated populist resistance of politically awakened and historically resentful peoples to external control has proven to be increasingly difficult to suppress.
The second phase of the revolution is strategic noncompliance, or more accurately, defiance. This can take many forms, and multiple approaches can be used at the same time. The goal of strategic noncompliance is to interrupt the chain of obedience for as long as possible, as many times as possible, to publicize that interruption on as large of a scale as possible, to document the police and or military brutality that follows, and to distribute that footage far and wide. The purpose of this is to damage the ruling party's image, because power is all about image. It's all smoke and mirrors. Once that image starts to break down, this inspires others to disobey. Monkey see, monkey do. And when this catches on and contagion sets in, it becomes a force of nature, like a tidal wave. It's all about reaching critical mass. What's crucial to understand here is that revolutions are almost entirely psychological in nature. In this context, building confidence is the most important element. Therefore, it's better to do small, successful operations and build up from there than it is to start with large, high-stakes events. The third stage of the revolution comes when the people have built up the necessary momentum to take the monopoly on violence out of the hands of the current regime. In the best of circumstances, such a transition can be relatively peaceful. But this is only possible when a significant portion of the police and the military have taken the side of the people. The police and military are the enforcement arm of the state, and without them, the powers that be have no power at all. Faltering governments almost always resort to brutal repression to attempt to stay in power. But this is often a fatal error. Even one refusal to follow an immoral order can set off a chain reaction that destroys the illusion of authority that they so carefully cultivate. Once that happens, it's game over. In East Germany, on November 7, 1989, the Communist Party ordered the military to put a stop to mass protests which had been growing throughout that year. The commander of the army refused, and he ordered his men to stand down. This sent a clear message that the Communist Party was no longer in control. This realization spread quickly through the population, and communism fell. Now, since this is such a crucial element in the equation, it's not something that should be left up to chance. Every effort needs to be made right now to reach out to the police and military, to help them wake up to what's going on, and to let them know that the people will support them if they break the chain of command. Now that we've outlined the big picture, let's look at two other key elements: leadership and organizational structure. Our current system relies on a hierarchical chain of command, a social pyramid which allows a small handful of individuals to control everyone else. In sociology, this is referred to as vertical collectivism. If our long-term vision is not compatible with such a structure, it would be foolish to build a resistance movement which copies it. Ends don't justify the means. The means will determine the end result. So if we want a decentralized, non-hierarchical federation of autonomous communities to replace the current system, the movement must be decentralized and non-hierarchical as well. This doesn't mean that there's no place for leadership. To the contrary, leadership is essential. The distinction needs to be made between leaders and rulers. Leaders walk ahead of the crowd. Rulers place themselves above the crowd. What's needed is a vast network of leaders, independently motivated and capable of thinking for themselves, working to organize groups both locally in the real world and online, unified not by obedience to a single leader, but unified by an idea. Now, while this approach does present some challenges logistically, it has the advantage of making it virtually impossible to destroy the organization merely by getting rid of one or two leaders. A distributed organizational structure is much more resilient. So, where are these leaders? Well, don't wait for them to appear. We need you to be one of those leaders. If you don't know how to be a leader, learn. Dealing with crowds is a skill, one that you can refine through practice and study. Anyone who wants to learn the basic psychology of uprisings and how to work with the public should study the following books intensely, reading them several times, taking notes and reflecting on what they say. Three books: The Crowd, The Psychology of Revolution by Gustave Le Bon, and From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. These books are all available online to read and download for free. You'll find links to these books in the description of this video. Now, a word of warning, these books contain politics, opinions, and prejudices that I did not endorse. Like all books, they should be read with a critical mind, questioning everything that's said. However, they do offer a great deal of insight as to how to take power out of the hands of a tyrant. Leadership takes many forms and can mean many things depending on the situation. However, the primary job of leaders is to inspire people to take action, to organize people into groups so they can be more effective than isolated individuals, and to train others to do the same. Now, the final element you need to start your revolution is tactics. In the realm of violence, the state has a definitive advantage, and it would be foolish to engage them where they are strongest. Instead, we should use tactics that engage them where they are weakest. Fortunately, there's no shortage of nonviolent tactics which have been proven effective in toppling dictatorships. Gene Sharp's book, From Dictatorship to Democracy, lists 198, but those are by no means the only ones that can be used. The tactics employed by each group will depend on the mission and the specific goals of the group. The military divides itself into Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine so that each can be specialized in the tactics of the terrain where they fight. Likewise, a nonviolent movement should have specialized groups for specific issues. This is already developing. We have PANDA, People Against the NDAA. PANDA is a national organization which has been working to fight the NDAA on a state and local level, and they've been having successes. What's most impressive is that the founder, Daniel Johnson, started this organization when he was 17. Also, there's the Oath Keepers, founded by Stuart Rhodes, which has been reaching out to the police and the military, reminding them of their oath, and preparing them psychologically to disobey when unconstitutional orders are handed down. The Oath Keepers have made a public stand against the NDAA, and they're gaining traction within the ranks. Others are organizing social media teams to collect and spread information. Others organize street activism, such as writing messages in chalk on sidewalks, or hanging up posters, or inserting small leaflets into books and magazines in the store. The possibilities are endless. Whether you start your own group, join an existing group, or act as an individual will depend on your disposition. No one can decide that for you. The most important thing is to take the first step, start doing something, anything. Take action and break the inertia of passivity. This is how you take back your power, 1 millimeter at a time. Now, right here, in this 15 minutes, you've been given enough information to start a revolution. You might need to watch this video more than once, and you will need to read those books. But now you have an instruction manual, something you can hand out to people and help them to learn. If you'd like more people to see this video, please share it through as many avenues as possible. Post it on Facebook, Twitter, on your blog, or send it to your friends via email. You have permission to download it, put it on disk, and distribute it on the streets. If you translate it, please post it as a video response so that it's easier for people to find. If you'd like more videos like this, subscribe to Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/StormCloudsGathering, on Twitter at Collapse Updates. You can find us on Google Plus by doing a search for Storm Clouds Gathering, and our website is stormcloudsgathering.com.
The Art of War by Sun Tzu. So this book is thousands of years old, and it is a very insightful book because it not only tells you about the different strategies and insightful ideas behind war and the aspects directly related to war. However, it contains within it a lot of information regarding on how to carry yourself in life and how to overcome one of the greatest obstacles that you have, which is your own ego and aspects of your mind and your character that you're essentially in battle with that keeps you away from doing the things that you know you have to do to produce the results that you want. It also helps you with dealing with day-to-day life, dealing with people, areas like business and career. So what I've done is I've pulled some points out of the book, and I want to share with you my insights and perspectives on this. And we're going to go through each point that I gathered from the chapters. There's 13 of them, and each chapter contains a different topic. And what it does is it explains, you know, the contents within it. There's a lot of proverbs and insightful information. No matter where you are in your life, it's worth reading this book because it's very revealing. It tells you about what is happening to you from areas that you're not aware of in life, because one of the important quotes from this book is all warfare is fought on deception, or is based on deception. And everyone is trying to get your attention in this world, and essentially your attention is really valuable. Advertisers pay a lot of money to get your attention. This can be beneficial because it can offer to you very valuable products and services, but it can also be disadvantageous if it takes you away from your purpose or your grand strategy, what you're trying to accomplish. So if you understand the aspects of war and the strategies and the concepts of war, then it will give you a deeper multi-level understanding of reality and yourself. A lot of people shy away from the subject of war, and I've never been one to do that because I realize that just about any type of information that is available is valid in certain areas, and we need to learn and understand from different sources, even if areas we don't necessarily agree with. There's a lot of different nuances and understandings, but the important thing is we have to make peace with what we're reading and who we are as a person, and one of the best ways to do that is to study very polarizing subjects. So if you're not a kind of person that studies war, for example, or you are opposed to war, then it's actually worth reading the war manuals because you'll gain a lot of insights to yourself. There's a saying that goes, what you resist persists. So the more you try to avoid studying certain subjects like war, the harder it is for you to overcome the certain aspects of yourself that the strategies of war and the concepts covered within this book can help you overcome so you can reach an even higher level. So we're going to start with the points. The first is all warfare is based on deception. So again, I'm going to apply this to life in general. I'm not going to apply this to war. I might make some references, but because the concepts and strategies that are contained within this book are applicable for day-to-day life. So that's what we're going to talk about from that perspective. All warfare is based on deception. So to me, it's essentially this world we live in where everyone is trying to take your attention away from what you're doing and put it into their space. So advertising, for example, or social media, or different people are trying to take your attention away, not necessarily from a sinister perspective, but because they believe they know what's best for you, and they're trying to take you towards their direction. Now, this can be advantageous or disadvantageous. A lot of times with the distractions we have nowadays in the realm of work, for example, career and business, they're not very advantageous, and even though the other person will tell you it's advantageous, you in your heart know it's not advantageous. So what you have to do is you have to put processes and systems in place to prevent your attention from going in a different direction. And part of that is the understanding that all warfare is based on deception. So a lot of things that you're attracted to are not necessarily beneficial for you. If you see a very attractive person, someone that you're very attracted to, understand something that that's only the surface what you see. There's probably a lot more to them and a lot more aspects to who they are that actually might not be beneficial for you. Okay, so this can be true and it can be false also. But you've got to look at where you're being deceived from seeing reality, from seeing the truth. And it's usually the things that trigger our fears and insecurities that pulls us towards a negative direction or in a direction that's not favorable to us. Next, attack him where he is unprepared. Appear where you are not expected. So again, when you look at software or certain kinds of apps and Facebook and things like that, they really understand this concept and they're really trying to, you can say, attack your mind and get you to go in a different direction when you are unprepared. So the key is to set up things in your environment to avoid distraction, to place yourself in environments that motivate and encourage a high level of focus from preventing yourself from being around people that essentially are looking to exploit you in a way that's not beneficial for you when you are unprepared. People are not going to attack you where you're strong. Your mind is not going to be penetrated where you're strong. It's always going to be in your weak areas. And it's going to appear when you are not expecting it to appear. So the important thing to understand is to look at all the different scenarios and situations in your life where you are unprepared and where you're not expecting distractions and things that will move you in a different direction, again, based on deception, and figure out how you can remove those so you can focus on what really matters to you. If your opponent is choleric temper, seek to irritate him. Pretend to be weak that he may grow arrogant. So again, one of the things that takes us away from what we are trying to do is emotions. People target our emotions. Advertisers target our emotions. Everything is designed to target your emotions. And one of the most powerful emotions is anger and irritation. So if people are angering you or irritating you, take a step back and understand that they may or may not be aware of what they're doing, but the bottom line is that it's impacting you. So that what you have to do is remove yourself from those situations. Again, pretend to be weak that he may grow arrogant. So another thing is that on the offensive side, you want to be humble. You want to be a kind of person that is very, pragmatic and going about your day-to-day activities, because then what happens is that those that are sinister and out to get you, they're going to grow arrogant. They're going to create a false sense of identity that they're winning and so forth, and that's going to eventually take them down. Now, that's actually a good thing, because when somebody does not get results based on reality and they get results based on arrogance and egotistical reasons, then that's not serving people and they need to go down. And one of the ways that you can facilitate that in a way that doesn't necessarily cause you to fight a battle with them is to be humble. Hold out baits to entice the enemy, fiend disorder, and crush him. Again, people are using bait to try to lure you in a different direction. Now, I'm not saying these things to make the world seem like it's a negative place. That's not what I'm saying. The reality of these things do exist, and what we have to do is proactively be responsible for protecting ourselves or protecting our attention and different areas that are important to us, and understand when we're being baited by the enemy, because the bait is going to take you astray. It's going to lead you astray. Next, waging war. In war, then let your objective be victory, not lengthy campaigns. So this is applicable in a lot of areas of life. For example, in business, one of the things that I see people do in business is they create these lengthy campaigns, these lengthy business objectives that take forever to implement, and projects that are very complex, and it prolongs the victory. Or even if they get there, they screw it up because there's so much complexity to it, and they don't end up actually getting the victory. They end up losing. So the ideal scenario is quick campaigns that are designed to victory, one of the quickest routes to the end result. I remember I was at an event and I heard Daymond John speak, who's the founder of FUBU, and he said he tries to be one step away from the money, which essentially what that means is that, and he's an investor, he's looking for businesses that are quick and efficient to produce the outcome. Okay, so you see the application here? And it's not about creating these lengthy processes and lengthy steps to get to the end result, because that just adds unnecessary complexity, but for looking for the quick end result through a short and efficient campaign. Now, this doesn't mean get rich quick or something that is essentially a trick that is not sustainable. There's a balance here. But it does mean that you can simplify the process and it doesn't have to be as lengthy as it should. Next, attack by stratagem. Thus, we may know there are five essentials for victory. He will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. So essentially what that means is conserve your energy. Live to fight the battles that are worth fighting. Don't give your attention onto things that when you win, they're just for egotistical reasons. They're not actually moving your objective forward. He will win who knows how to handle both superior and inferior forces. So understand that some people are superior and some are inferior. You need to be able to work with those energies to move your strategy forward. Again, if you're focused on an objective outcome that is based on strategy and not based on egotistical reasons, then you're going to see the possibilities and opportunities to work with these different superior and inferior forces. When someone is superior to us, we tend to put on a certain persona. We try to impress them. We end up doing things that don't necessarily move our objective forward. When someone is inferior, we try to take advantage of them. We try to be the right one. We try to be the lecturer instead of the person that works with them to move the objective forward. He will win whose army is animated by the same spirit throughout all its ranks. So when you're creating a team, for example, if you're building a business, everyone needs to have that spirit. Anytime the spirit is broken, you've got a weak link. You have to be able to penetrate your organization with that same spirit. If you can't penetrate the ranks and there's hierarchy in it, understand something. When it gets up to a certain level and that spirit is not there, everyone who that person has as far as responsibility, if that person is a leader, anyone who's responsible to them is not going to have that same spirit, because as it trickles down, when it gets to that level where there's the inefficiency of thinking or the lack of spirit, everyone under that person is going to have that lack of spirit, because the information which comes from the top down is not going to be translated in a way where it's uniform. And that becomes very weak. It becomes cancerous to the organization, and it can be resulting, or it can result in taking down the entire operation and so forth. He will win who prepared himself, waits to take the enemy unprepared. So you always have to be prepared. You always have to be on. This doesn't mean you can't relax, but when you relax, make sure you do it in an environment where you cannot be persuaded and attacked. You can be vulnerable. But it's important to then place yourself in situations where you are prepared and where people can't take advantage of you, and you're able to read the signs. You're able to become very present and know when you're getting pulled in a direction that is not favorable for you. And when you're dealing with people, and you have to move the strategy forward, and you have to attack, do it in a place where there's less resistance, essentially when they're unprepared. He will win who has military capacity and is not interfered with by the sovereign. So next we're going to move on to tactical dispositions. What the ancients called a clever fighter is one who not only wins, but excels in winning with ease. Hence his victories bring him neither reputation for wisdom nor credit for courage. So if you're a very skillful fighter and you always win, or you're in a state of mind of winning, when you win, it's not a big deal. It's just a way of life. It's just what happens from day to day. That's how you know that you are in the ranks of someone great, is when they're looking at the victories as just another step forward. This doesn't mean that they are not appreciative of it. It just means that they don't become arrogant and form an identity around their victories. When you become arrogant and form an identity, or you feed the ego around your victories, that ego becomes your weak area. You're no longer performing from the same place that got you the victories. And then when you face higher challenges, that ego is going to hold you back. You're going to need to break it down. Thus, it is war, that is that in war, that victorious strategists only seek battle after the victory has been won. Whereas he who is destined to defeat first fights and afterwards looks for victory. So this is about controlling your emotions, getting really present, and understanding that you need to look at strategy and you got to see the end result. And you got to go down the pathway that is statistically likely to produce the result that you want. If you don't see the steps that lead to the outcome, you need to figure out how to see the steps. Because if you don't see the steps, then you're essentially going and fighting a battle where you don't necessarily know the outcome. Now, there's going to be situations where the odds are not in your favor. And if you have the opportunity to go in a direction, another direction where the odds are in your favor and that can move your grand strategy forward, why wouldn't you pick it? So it's important to think like a strategist, and understanding strategy is a massive subject. It takes a lot of experience, a lot of studying to really grasp the magnitude, and it goes on forever. The study of becoming a better strategist goes on forever. It deploys both in the moment thinking and being present to the variables that are contained within the moment, as well as long-range thinking, so you can see the domino effect, the trickle effect, the pattern recognition, the possible scenarios that can occur in the position that you're taking or in the environment that you're going in, and knowing how to work with it when it shows up. Energy. Sun Tzu said, "The control of large forces occur in the position that you're taking or in the environment that you're going in, and knowing how to work with it when it shows up." Energy. Sun Tzu said, "The control of large forces is the same principle as the control of a few men. It is merely a question of dividing up their numbers." So what this means is that you've got to create a system. You've got to create a process. And that system and process will allow it to scale to higher levels. When you're building a team, the same ideologies that you instill at a lower level with a few people are instilled as the organization grows. And as the organization grows, there are people, there are processes and systems that are put in place to infuse the new people that are brought on board with the ways of how it works and the spirit. And as it starts to increase, the control is maintained through hierarchy and reporting and certain things in place that when a decision needs to be executed from the top down, it flows through the entire organization and everybody executes in synergy. Now, it's a lot simpler than it sounds because you're dealing with people, and people can be irrational and overly emotional and have their own agendas, but you try to do it the best you can. Okay, so next, in the battle, there are not more than two methods of attack, the direct and the indirect. Yet these two combinations give rise to an endless series of maneuvers. So think about in life, when it's important to be direct when dealing with people, and when it's important to be indirect. Sometimes when you're dealing with people, you have to be direct because they can handle it, or they can handle it in certain times, or they require it to feel your trustworthiness. But in other times, it's important to be indirect because by being indirect, you give them some space. You help them understand things in a level where they figure it out on their own. One of my favorite sayings is, let the thoughts you are provoking come to them as if they were their own. That's done through indirect methods. Through indirect methods, you're not being manipulative, but you're rather just being supportive. You're stepping back and understanding that people are in different levels. They have fears, they have insecurities, they have different agendas and goals and certain priorities and so forth. And you got to be able to work with that in a way that might require being indirect. Energy might be likened to bending of a crossbow, decision to the releasing of a trigger. So energy is essentially a lot of presence, a lot of awareness, and a buildup of focus. And then you're able to look at what you're trying to accomplish and releasing that buildup of energy. You have to be able to feel it. You can feel the energy. A lot of people nowadays are not really becoming present to the energy of their environment, the energy when it comes to dealing with people. It's almost become kind of a far-out concept, but it really isn't. You can feel when somebody has good energy, charismatic energy, negative energy. You can feel it, and you can get better at feeling it. And within yourself, when you've got focused energy or powerful present energy or energy that's very positive or it's purposeful, you can allow that energy to build up so it intensifies. And then when it's time to make your move, you can release and infuse that move with your energy. Amid the turmoil and tumult of battle, there may be seeming disorder, and yet no real disorder at all. Amid confusion and chaos, your array may be without head or tail, yet it will be proof against defeat. So, when you look at an environment, a marketplace, life in general, you'll tend to notice chaos. You will see disorder. Things won't make sense. Understand something, that within that chaos, there is a process. There is order. Your goal as a strategist is to be able to see order through the chaos, not be pulled in through the chaos. I know people that consider themselves to be strategists, but they're not able to hold composure during tough situations, or they might be at a level where they are not able to be a strategist. So the way I look at it is different levels require different levels of strategic thinking. Different kinds of chaotic environments require different strategists. Someone who's a grand strategist, someone at a really high level, is able to maintain their presence of mind and see the process in the chaos. And they're able to take what they see and translate it into the maneuvers that they get their team to do. This is something that is very apparent in people that have a lot of experience. There's a concept, a German military term called Fingerspitzengefühl. Essentially what it means is fingertip feel. And essentially it's the ability to feel the environment that you're in. And while you have a lot of different strategies in your mind, while you have a lot of different tactics, based on the environment and what you feel, be able to deploy the right strategy to move it forward, to move the objective forward. This comes through experience. Those that were masterful war generals were said to have possessed Fingerspitzengefühl. So what you need to realize is that you need to train yourself so that when you are in chaos, you can maintain presence of mind. One of the best ways to do it is to place yourself in chaotic situations. A lot of people try to avoid chaotic situations, but what you should do is systematically and strategically and intentionally place yourself in chaotic situations so you could see the process that exists within the chaos. Next, weak points and strong. Sun Tzu said, "Whoever is first in the field and awaits the coming of the enemy will be fresh for the fight. Whoever is second in the field has to hasten to battle, will arrive, and has to hasten to battle, will arrive exhausted. Therefore, the clever combatant imposes his will on the enemy, but does not allow the enemy's will to be imposed on him." You have to be prepared, organized, and show up to your engagements and things that you do with a vibe and an energy of you controlling the dynamics. If you show up with a vibe of not having control of the dynamics, and the other person shows up with a strategic, clear-thinking mind to control the dynamics, then you are at the mercy of them because they will exploit your weaknesses. They will exploit the areas that you're weak at. Now, the key to this is to schedule things, is to pre-plan things, is to think long range and look at all the possible different scenarios that could show up that could hinder what you have to do or that could throw you off, and then plan accordingly. You have to be able to show up and prepare for whatever it is, the negotiation, the meeting, the discussion, the business, the whatever it is, by preparing yourself for that interaction by doing things prior. It could be like working out, exercise, eating healthy, a lot of different things. I don't know what the routine is. For different scenarios, it's different things. But if you come prepared to play, then you're going to be more advantageous than people that don't. What I find in the business world is that people show up unprepared far more often than they should. And they go unprepared not just because You know, they might have like the minutes or whatever else, the points of the meeting, but they're unprepared emotionally. They get in an argument with their spouse or boyfriend and girlfriend. They're having road rage as they're driving to the client meeting and so forth. There's a lot of different scenarios that throw them off, and that's part of the preparation. You have to be prepared physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually when you show up to the engagement. An army may march great distances without distress if it marches through country where the enemy is not. To me, this is all about not fighting the battles that you don't need to fight. If you are able to go to a destination and take a route that doesn't involve you fighting the battle or unnecessary friction, why not take it so that when you get there, you're better prepared? You show up with a presence of mind. Now, there are some situations, like I said earlier, where you want to put yourself in chaotic situations, but it's not always advantageous to be in those chaotic situations prior to a interaction where you have to be your freshest. Now, sometimes it can mix you up and get you out of your head, and you should do that. But the key to this is understanding that there are different kinds of avenues or pathways to get to a destination. And if your enemy, or enemy in this scenario can also be yourself, because you can be triggered by certain circumstances in the environment, throws you off, when you get there, you're just going to end up using your mental resources or whatever resources inefficiently. Rouse him and learn the principles of his, or the principle of his activity or inactivity. Force him to reveal himself as to find out his vulnerable spots. So essentially, in the business world, we're looking for different exploits that exist in the marketplace and in our competition so that we can position ourselves at that exploit and take that market share, penetrate through that exploit, and expansively take the market share over time. There's a lot of them that exist. We have to be able to deny our competition of these exploits or these vulnerable spots, and we have to be able to find what these vulnerable spots are in the marketplace and with our competition. This requires, again, direct and indirect methods. We talked about this earlier. Direct and indirect methods to get the person to reveal. Now, what's interesting is on the internet, we have different tools and software and code and stuff like that that is able to spy on the competitor to be able to see what their vulnerabilities are and so forth. But never underestimate the power of social engineering, the ability to connect with people and get valuable data out of them to further your objective. All men can see the tactics whereby I conquer, but what none can see is the strategy out of which victory is evolved. A lot of people are too tactical in their orientation in life. They look at the few things that you do, and they conclude that by you doing those few things, that it produces a result. They will fail to see your grand strategy, all the other things that happen in the background, and the why you do those tactical things, even if you win or lose, because sometimes it's okay to strategically lose if it moves the objective forward. They don't see the strategy, and the reason why they don't see the strategy is because they're not strategic thinking. A lot of people don't necessarily like thinking from a strategic standpoint because it actually forces them to really work the brain, to really work the logical aspects, the ability to recognize patterns, an important aspect of human existence. They're not necessarily motivated to do it. You, on the other hand, need to become motivated to do it. You need to become more strategic. You can develop your strategic thinking by looking at different components, analytical data, so forth, and looking for the insights and figuring out why things are, why they are based on what happened, and what happens if you try this other thing, and what direction do you go on, looking at optimization and things like that. When you develop strategic thinking, you can evolve your grand strategy. You can create strategies that other people won't be able to understand because their mind is closed off to only seeing the tactics. They're not seeing the strategy. Do not repeat the tactics which have gained you one victory, but let your methods be regulated by the infinite variety of circumstances. Fingerspitz and Gefühl, I talked about this earlier. Most environments that you place yourself in are going to be different. Actually, every environment that you place yourself in that you fight battle or whatever it is you're trying to do is going to be different. You have to be able to train yourself to not be too fixated on one methodology to get the results. Diversify the moves that you make so you can gain better understanding and the different aspects of what makes that environment the way it is, the components that make up the whole, and how the environment responds to the different moves you make, not just the moves you make in a one-step way, but in a multidimensional way, in a sequential way, in a way that's combined with the different patterns of possibility. And you have to be able to do that. So when you achieve victory in one area, try to achieve victory in many different areas, even outside of the realm of your craft, so you can develop a more multidimensional mind, which thinks more strategically, that looks for more opportunities for victory when you are placed in certain scenarios. Water shapes its course according to the nature of the ground over which it flows. The soldier works out his victory in relation to the foe from whom he is facing. Therefore, just as water retains no shape, so in warfare there's no constant conditions. Again, this goes back to my previous point. You have to become like water, as Bruce Lee said. You have to be able to flow with the environment and the different things that happen. You can't be pissed off or offended that the environment didn't go the way that you want. Instead, you've got to shape shift and go in a different direction. And you got to be able to do it smoothly and quick and efficiently and gracefully like water does. And water is a very powerful force because you cannot block the buildup of water pressure over time. It will break through unless you've got a wall or a dam that's strategically, or not strategically, but more powerful to hold it in. But if the pressure builds up greater than that, then it's going to break through. So now the key to important aspect to understand is that if you become like water, you essentially flow. And what you're flowing is against the variables, against the exploits, against the competition and what people are trying to do to you, and you're moving around it, you're moving above it, you're moving below it, you're moving sometimes through it as you move as a force, and you're okay with it. You're not being offended when things don't go your way. You're quickly collaborating, or calibrating, I should say, to the environment, and it's because of Fingerspitz and Gefühl. We're not fit to lead an army on the march unless we are familiar with the face of the country, its mountains and forests, its pitfalls and precipices, its marshes and swamps. Familiarizing yourself with the terrain and your environment as much as you can is very important. This doesn't necessarily mean you overthink it and you dedicate all your time to familiarizing yourself before you take action, but instead, it's worth developing the ability to familiarize yourself in the environment by taking action, because there's way more dynamics at play. Sometimes the environment responds to certain actions that you take. So what happens is, by doing that action, you stir up the environment and you see a certain kind of response. So by analyzing the terrain and everything, and then seeing how everything responds based on different kinds of actions, you're able to come up with different combinations and permutations to deploy as far as strategies towards your objective outcome. Let your plans be dark and impenetrable as night, and when you move, fall like a thunderbolt. So to put up unnecessary resistance, or to remove unnecessary resistance, work in the backgrounds, reveal very little of what you're trying to do, because that what you're trying to reveal to somebody, or what you're revealing to somebody, will be used against you by your competition. So when you work in the background, you're being humble, you're looking at your outcome, and you're focused on the outcome, and you're not interested in what other people think of you or how you look to others. Instead, you do your daily disciplines, you do your work, and it's done in silence, in quiet. And it moves forward what needs to move forward to make the outcome possible. And what needs to be revealed is revealed. So think about that for a moment. What you reveal should be revealed for strategic reasons, either for reasons to recruit more people into your objective, or to reveal certain kinds of stimulus to the environment in which you look at the response you get and you adjust from there, or to create a form of deception for your enemies who try to take you out. But the moves that don't need to be revealed happen in silence. Those are the ones that move everything forward. And as they move everything forward, essentially all the facade, all the surface level stuff is looked at the way it's supposed to be looked at. And it appears even to your competitors and your enemies that you're not making any progress, but it turns out that underground you're making a lot of progress. Now a soldier's spirit is keenest in the morning. By noonday, it has begun to flag, and in the evening, his mind is bent only on returning to camp. A clever general, therefore, avoids an army when its spirit is keen, but attacks when it's sluggish and inclined to return. This is the art of studying moods. So very self-explanatory, we've already covered that. Variations in tactics. There are five dangerous faults which may affect a general. Number one, recklessness, which leads to destruction. Cowardice, which leads to capture. A hasty temper, which can be provoked by insults. A delicacy of honor, which is sensitive to shame. So these are applicable in business, when dealing with people, relationships, and so forth. How many times do we act inappropriately or fail to act as a result of this? You can use these as a checklist, actually, to understand your actions or lack thereof. The art of war teaches us not to rely on the likelihood of the enemy's not coming, but on our own readiness to receive him. Not on the chance of his not attacking, but rather on the fact that we have made our position unassailable. So essentially what this means is that you've always got to be prepared. You've always got to be as efficient with what you do, how you work with your team, your learning, your studying, and essentially your ability to think logically and critically, as well as being present to the moment, understanding the forces and dynamics in play, and essentially just educating yourself through real-life action-taking and the results you get based on the actions you take from the environment and your competitors and so forth. And not leaving things up to chance and not being slack on the areas that you need to improve on. If you see weaknesses, go to work and improve those weaknesses. Improve them right away. Prioritize and focus on the ones that produce the greatest output or the ones that have your greatest weaknesses that can be exploited. Focus on those first, but make sure you address everything with time and try to do it as fast as you can, because if you are ready, you don't have to get ready when the enemy shows up. When the enemy shows up, they'll see how strong you are and they'll turn around and go away, because a lot of times they're looking to fight you where you're weak. If they know you can win, on the flip side, I mentioned this earlier, you don't fight battles where you know you're going to lose. If they know that they're going to lose, they're not going to fight you. And thus, your preparation, your discipline and everything will prevent a lot of attacks that would have possibly come to you as a result, of all the preparation and proactiveness that you've taken in everything you do. Because I believe how you do one thing is how you do everything. The army on the march. If in training soldiers, commands are habitually enforced, the army will be well disciplined. If not, its discipline will be bad. Consistency with your people is very important. If you put a process in place, until you actually say the process is going to end, you have to be consistent with it. Because if you're not consistent with it, they're not going to have any respect for you. They're going to say that, hey, this is a weak area. This person has a weak area, and they have probably way more weak areas, and I don't see that person as a leader. A leader goes first and enforces certain commands and habits and puts systems and processes in place to make sure it's consistent as much as possible. The more there is consistency, the more respect there is. But if there is slack, the respect will be lost, and the army will follow suit. They'll think it's okay to not have self-discipline, and the processes that they deploy don't matter either for the people that they deploy them to, and it's going to be a chain of chaos, and not in the type of chaos that I mentioned earlier that grows you, but a chaos that essentially will bring your organization down. If a general shows confidence in his men, but always insists on his orders being obeyed, the gain will be mutual. So again, having confidence in people is trusting. But that doesn't mean you don't have reports and processes in place that keeps your finger on the pulse so you can understand what's going on, and then based on what's going on, you make decisions. So your orders essentially are being obeyed, but they're not doing it in a way where it makes the person feel restrained. You have to believe in them, but you also have to understand that there's human nature, and you have to put things in place to prevent the bad behaviors. Terrain. If fighting is sure to result in victory, then you must fight, even though the ruler forbid it. If fighting will not result in victory, then you must not fight, even at the ruler's bidding. So this is where you have to be able to use your own judgment. Sometimes you're going to have to break the rules. That's okay. If the breaking of the rule provides the victory, then you should do it. And if the breaking of the rule has no consequences, then you should do it. Now, there's many nuances to this, but that's essentially what it's getting at. Sometimes a strategist might deploy a strategy out there and expect people to follow it. If a person is out in the arena, on the battlefield, and they've encountered a scenario which they feel that most likely the person who gave the orders, the strategist, couldn't see it, and they have to make a decision, and they know that by making the decision it goes against the orders of the strategist, but however it creates a victory, then they should do it. And the strategist should be able to empower his people or her people to be able to make decisions on their own, if those kind of regards do show up. Regard your soldiers as your children, and they will follow you into the deepest valleys. Look upon them as your own loved sons, and they will stand by you even unto death. So this is important to treat people in your organization like a family. You have to be able to create that in your organization. And you have to have a lot of respect for them and compassion for them, and you have to be really interested in them doing better than you have done. And it's interesting because by having this kind of view where you want them to do their best, it's paradoxical because they might actually leave you. But because you've risen up so much that you care for their well-being, they probably won't leave you because they recognize that you are an inspirational source, a person in their life that actually really cares about them. And that's kind of rare in organizations because a lot of people who run organizations, they don't want people to leave because then they'll put all these systems in place to prevent people from leaving. It's like scarcity thinking. Essentially, they just want to keep people there. And that restrains them, and they don't feel like they're cared for. The people in the organization don't feel like they're cared for. And then what happens is they do end up leaving. It ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. However, the paradox of wanting the best for your people, even more so that if they leave you, you will still be happy for them, grows and builds the organization to such a high level that they can't leave you. And if they do leave you, they'll figure out some partnership with you in which both parties will win. Hence the saying, if you know the enemy and know yourself, your victory will not stand in doubt. If you know heaven and you know earth, you may make your victory complete. This is again about knowing what battles you should fight, studying the components of your enemy, your competitors, etc., and understanding where your strengths and weaknesses are, and focusing, if you're going to battle them, on their weaknesses with your strengths, understanding what your weaknesses are, and they're going to essentially attack your weaknesses with their strengths to put up defensive or deceptive methods to deflect the awareness on your weaknesses and put that awareness on your strengths. So they try to attack you with arrogance on your strengths, but meanwhile you're strong there because you have essentially smokescreen them to go in a different direction. That is all the kind of things that's important to understand prior to getting into battle, prior to going into the environment. Now, a lot of times you can't get all that data, but the objective is to get as much of that data as possible. And if you need to fight a battle, try to put it more in your favor as possible. And that comes as a result by knowing yourself, your strengths, your weaknesses, your people, and so forth, that go to battle with you, and that same of the opponent. The nine situations. Throw your soldiers into positions where there is no escape, and they will prefer death to flight. If they face death, there is nothing they may not achieve. Officers and men alike will put forth their utmost strength. This is called the death ground strategy, and the death ground strategy is something we can actually do for ourselves. We can take ourselves from the comfort and luxury of escaping out of the battle and actually place ourselves where we have to make out victorious. We have to be victorious or we end up perishing. Now, you could do this through accountability. One of the things that I like to do is if I don't complete my list of tasks in my business, for example, by the end of the day that have been outlined at the start of the day, then I have to donate a certain amount of money to somebody. A lot of different things that you can do that essentially causes you to feel the burn if you don't, if you're not able to achieve the outcome, and thus it'll motivate you and force you to do it. And you can be really creative with this, but we have to have something like that if we find ourselves constantly not hitting our objectives. Prohibit the taking of omens and do away with superstitious doubts. Then until death itself comes, no calamity need be feared. So one of the things that I like to do is avoid any type of superstitious doubts. If something is superstitious and it's going to help me think more empowered and it's going to move me forward, then I'm going to accept it. But if something says that I can't do what my grand strategy or my purpose in life is to be, I'm not going to believe it. And the reason why I'm not going to do that is because it distorts the mind. It's essentially a weakness. When your brain is injected or infiltrated with a doubt or an idea that you can't achieve the outcome that you want by somebody else or the environment, then what will happen is that you're going to look for ways to not get the outcome that you want. So it's good to make sure that you only internalize the concepts that ensure you victory while being aware of the things that could hold you back or that could stand in your way, but not becoming doubtful of yourself as a result of them. Next, by altering his arrangements and changing his plans, he keeps the enemy without definite knowledge. By shifting his camp and taking circuitous routes, he prevents his enemy from anticipating his purpose. So essentially what this means is that you have to be able to constantly switch up the routine that you have in place if you're in a very competitive environment. If you have a lot of people that are trying to take your position, or if you have a lot of people that are trying to take you out, not in a positive way, then switching up your things that you do, your routines, your plans, and everything like that will mix up your enemy. They won't be able to figure you out. And you might want to deploy some smokescreen strategies so that they think that they figured you out from a certain place, only to have them be led astray and wasting their time, essentially, while you're actually making the moves that you need to make. This goes back to what I talked about earlier, where you have to be humble and not look for validation and certain kinds of approval from the environment and so forth. You're essentially looking for objective data to help your strategy move forward. And as a result of that, you're going to have no need to want to impress people and do things in an environment where people can see in a conspicuous way. Instead, you're going to do it underground where people can't see, and they're only going to know what you want them to know about you or what they need to know about you depending on what your strategic outcome is. But your real grand strategy is done in silence, and people can never figure you out. Even if they try their hardest, they'll never be able to figure it out, because when you know they're trying to figure you out, you're going to give them certain information to lead them astray. If the enemy leaves a door open, you must rush in. So again, when it comes to marketplace, when it comes to competition, your job is to exploit it, and exploit it in a way, obviously, that's ethical, but exploit it when it's open. If you miss the opportunity, you might not get it again. Every market or every competitor, even yourself, it's very unlikely that you're going to be 100% spot on with everything you do. Like, it's very unlikely. So there are exploits. There are weak areas. You have to train yourself to be able to look for the exploits and the weak areas. Train yourself to do that in people. And it doesn't mean you actually act on the exploits and the weak areas, but you study how to look for exploits in weak areas. And if you need to act on them, you do it. If it's going to essentially hold you back, if that person's trying to hold you back, or if you need to, so you can move the position forward, again, make sure that you're being ethical when you do this, because there's repercussions in areas like business and so forth. So the key here is understanding how to determine what an exploit is and where a door is left open and figure out how you can get in there in many different areas of your life, and then knowing when to do it and when not to do it. Next, the attack of fire. Move not unless you see an advantage. Use not your troops unless there is something to be gained. Fight not unless the position is critical. You have time, you have energy, you have opportunity cost, you have resources, and you have to be able to work with these. If you don't know how to work with them, you're going to exhaust yourself and you're not going to achieve your grand strategy. Same thing applies to business. If you see an advantage, then you move forward. If you don't see an advantage, why would you move forward on that thing when there's probably other things that you can do that there is advantage? Try to focus on things that have the advantage and that require as minimum input that can produce maximum output as possible. Again, I talked about this earlier in the example when I brought up what Damon John said about opportunity. One step away from the money, in the sense that you're looking for opportunities that are not like get rich quick, but essentially opportunities that are arbitrage or that can easily be captured from the environment and executed upon, instead of creating this complex process and all these different things you got to do just to eventually and inevitably hit the same outcome or the same level of profitability that you could have hit had you had shifted your thinking more into a different direction where you move only on advantages. Okay, and again, your troops and your people are valuable resources. You have to be able to move towards an advantage as quick as possible so you can get that outcome, so you can gather more resources, so you can build your troops further, and then the same applies to them. You have to instill that philosophy in them. And a lot of times, fighting is not necessary. You know, Sun Tzu talked about this. Even though this book is about war, essentially, the ideal goal is to win the war without any casualties, or to win the war with the fewest amount of casualties. Not just, you know, brute force go at it. This is strategy. Strategy is not done that way. So you don't need to fight battles unless it's absolutely critical, because those battles can be costly. And you only fight the battles if you know you're going to win or the odds are in favor. If you have to fight a battle and the odds are not in favor, well, then maybe what you've done is you've not preemptively and proactively figured out all the dynamics at play that got you into that situation, and that could be too late. But that's why it's important to start now and work with what you have. Most likely, we're not in a situation where it's do or die, and there's things we can do to prevent ourselves from being in a situation where it's do or die. So the key is to focus on that right now and place ourselves in as many situations where it's advantageous, but also in situations that we don't find ourselves in a critical need to fight. Again, if it is to your advantage, make a move forward. If it's not, stay where you are. One of my favorite sayings that I got when I was 24 years old from a very successful entrepreneur who was around that age, very successful, he said, "When in doubt, do nothing." And I've been reflecting upon that for many years, when in doubt, do nothing. And over the years, I tend to implement it more and more. And the reason why it took me so long to internalize it is because when you hear a very simple statement like that, oftentimes we overthink it and we add more complexity to it, and then we don't end up doing it. But then as you move up to higher levels and you can handle a higher level of complexity and you place yourself in different environments and you study these philosophies and you see how they work in the world and so forth, you realize that those very simplistic truths are oftentimes the way to go. So when you're in doubt, there's probably some aspect of whatever it is that you want to do that you're not analyzing or figuring out or being aware of, that essentially if you execute upon it, it's not going to result in a favorable outcome. So what I try to do is I try to place myself in as many situations that if I execute upon them, there's no doubt. But if there is a doubt, I don't execute upon it, because in any given moment of time, you could either go left or right. Okay, so you're right now listening to this, you could stop and do something else, or you could do something outside of whatever else you were going to do. There's only a few choices that you can make, but each of those choices have a trickle effect of other choices and so forth. So there's no point in doubting something and sitting on that doubt, because it just burns the mental resources instead, it's better to be analytical about it and think about what the implications are and so forth, but just simply doubting something and executing upon it when there are things that you can execute upon that have no doubt, that are no-brainers, that will produce a result, isn't it better to do that? Use of spies. Knowledge of the enemy's dispositions can be obtained from other men, hence the use of spies, of whom there are five classes. Local spies. Having local spies means employing the services of the inhabitants of a district. Inward spies. Having inward spies, making use of officials of the enemy. Converted spies. Having converted spies, getting hold of the enemy's spies and using them for your own purpose. Doom spies. Having doom spies, doing things openly for purposes of deception and allowing our spies to know of them and report them to the enemy. Surviving spies. Surviving spies, finally, are those who bring back news from the enemy's camp. So, different kinds of spies, and the spies essentially is designed to help you understand the enemy. Again, know yourself and know your enemy. Okay? You have to know yourself and you have to know who you're up against. Now, there's also the enemy within yourself, and figure out some creative ways to infiltrate the enemy within yourself, which is your own ego. Study yourself, and then study your external world. That's how you know yourself. That's how you know your external world. That's how you know the people. Because just as we go back to the beginning of the book, all warfare is fought on deception. So that means most likely you're being deceived by the people in front of you. And again, it's not about being paranoid, but rather being objective and focused and aware that these dynamics exist and it's a way of life. And if you want to rise up to higher levels of success, or you want to play in environments where there's high amounts of competition, understand that this stuff is being used. Don't be in denial about it. And then figure out ways to work with it so you can come out advantageous. The enemy spies who have come to spy on us must be sought out, tempted with bribes, led away, and comfortably housed. They will become converted spies and available for our own service. So again, know, just as you are deploying methodologies to research your competition, other people are doing the same to you. And there's many different ways of working with the people that they send to you so that they can give them misinformation or give you information from your competitors and so forth. Hope you enjoyed this video. This is a lot of information contained within this book, and I'm not doing it any justice by just sharing these high-level points. As you can see, we've been discussing for about an hour, and we've only covered like a handful of points here. And essentially, this book is something that you need to refer to as much as possible in different stages of your life to give you deeper level insights. There's a lot more of insights if you go and study this book. And again, like I mentioned in the beginning, studying war might not be in the top of the list for people. But however, I think it should be, because it reveals an important aspect of human nature. War does exist. The war exists, you know, not just like traditional war, what we actually consider war, but competitiveness in business environments, career, social environments, etc. And the war in our own mind with our own ego and things like that do exist. So we have to be able to study it, understand it, and apply it and be aware of the different aspects and refer to something like Sun Tzu's Art of War for insights and revelations for pieces that we might not have figured out yet, because that's what this book's really helpful for. If you want a copy of this mind map, it's in the bottom of this video in the link in the description. Thank you very much for watching this video. Hope you enjoyed it. I will talk to you soon. Take care.
fucking song!